Welcome back to part two of our special edition of the North of Scotland Parkinson's Research Interest Group podcast. So we have been running a series of podcasts in mark of World Mental Health Day in conjunction with Parkinson's UK. So you may very well have joined our previous pod where we had a focus on anxiety. We were joined by the amazing Dr. Jennifer Foley and Emma Edwards, where we discussed all things anxiety. So the focus, we're having a little bit of a gear change, and we're talking about another very prevalent non-motor symptom that affects a large number of people with Parkinson's. So today's podcast is going to focus on depression. So as per the previous podcast, I am joined by my co-host today, Neil Morrison, who's a fellow member of the North of Scotland Parkinson's Research Interest Group, and who's a key advocate for research and research participation for people living with the condition. So admirably placed to join me on the pod today. Just some general introductions, just in case people haven't caught the prior post. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by two very distinguished guests. A very warm welcome to both Jennifer Foley and Emma Edwards. So Dr. Jennifer Foley is a senior clinical neuropsychologist at the National Hospital for Neurology and Neurosurgery, and she's also an honorary lecturer at UCL Queen Square, the Institute of Neurology. And she has a specific interest in movement disorders, but she's also the lead of the Parkinson's UK Excellence Network Hub for Mental Health. And she's involved in a large number of research trials looking at new treatments, particularly with a focus on cognitive and emotional symptoms for people with Parkinson's. Emma Edwards is a nurse who's been working in the field of mental health for a long time and has had a number of different roles within that capacity. So she joined the Parkinson's team in 2010 in Cornwall, and then she moved to join the Plymouth team working with Parkinson's in 2019. And her real specialist interest, and indeed her passion, which came across amazingly strongly throughout the anxiety podcast, is about trying to improve things, all things mental health for her patients. And that currently, actually, interestingly, is currently seconded to a suicide prevention training program, really to help improve her knowledge in this area. So it's a very much underserved area of Parkinson's research. So I am joined by some really prestigious people today on the pod. So I hope you're going to enjoy this second pod in our World Mental Health Day series. So today, really, we are talking about depression in Parkinson's. And really, when we look at epidemiological studies which have looked at Parkinson's, there's quite a range, but these studies would suggest somewhere between 40 and 50 people of Parkinson's will report depression, whilst there even is some studies that suggest up to 90% of people with Parkinson's experience some form of depression at some time within their time that they've been diagnosed. So I guess the first question is really, what do we know about Parkinson's, and why is it so common in amongst people with Parkinson's, perhaps compared to other neurological conditions? And perhaps if I point that question at you right from the beginning, Jennifer, that would be super.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's probably a combination of the neurobiological changes as well as the impact that Parkinson's can have on your ability to do the things that you enjoy, and also your sense of self. So sometimes, you know, your perception of yourself might change. So, for example, if you're really into sport, or you really love doing certain things that somehow is impacted by the Parkinson's, then that can really impact your sense of self, your identity, who you think you are, and what. And sometimes, you know, that can be a lot more distressing than the actual physical symptoms itself. It's the way it makes you feel about yourself. And or for example, you know, if it affects your concentration and memory, and if you've always been, say, a university professor or something, and that's your big thing, is like your thinking skills, if they're diminished somehow because of Parkinson's, then that can be really, really difficult to cope with. So there's something about who you are and what means a lot to you, and how the symptoms impact that, as well as perhaps neurobiological changes that slow you down, that make you more tired, that are uncomfortable, pain. You know, everyone's a bit more ratty when they're in pain, so it makes sense that people, you know, can get quite down. So it is quite common, but it's, I would say, in my experience, it's not quite as common as anxiety. And when it occurs, it tends to occur alongside the anxiety. Sometimes you do get it on its own. There could be lots of despair or thoughts of not being able to want to see the future, or not being able to cope with the future and therefore not wanting to live to see it, which is obviously really a horrible way to be feeling. And then that's obviously when you need to sort of access proper support to get some mental health support for those sorts of more, despair is the sense. Yeah. I mean, this is like your specialist area, isn't it? Sort of.
It is, yeah. And, you know, it's, like I said, I've been a mental health nurse for a very long time. And to be honest, until I became a Parkinson's nurse, I don't think I realised how much people's mood was affected by this condition. So it's certainly something that I assess for every single time I have a consultation with somebody with Parkinson's. And as you were saying, you know, there's different treatments, and it's so dependent on the individual. But I would be thrown out the mental health nurse club if I didn't say that talking and talking therapies, or just talking to somebody that you trust, you know, that's going to help your mood. You know, I think we're hardwired for connection. And I think that just makes us feel a lot better by just getting it off our chest and saying, do you know what, I'm just struggling. And sometimes, you know, again, you know, similar to the treatments with anxiety, you know, having a good night's sleep can improve mood. What you eat, who you interact with, what you do in your day, all of those things are great for mood. But it can get to a point where, as Jennifer rightly said, where more specialist intervention is needed. And that might be something at your GP surgery. So most GP surgeries now have a mental health clinician connected to it. It may be a talking therapy with the NHS. It may be psychotherapy that you access privately. There's various sort of support systems out there. Most places as well in the UK have specialist mental health crisis lines available 24 hours a day. The Samaritans, you know, they're absolutely fantastic if someone is really, really struggling with their mental health and they just need somebody to talk to. So I think there's lots of things out there. They're not accessible for everyone. We've got to be realistic here. There's waiting lists in our NHS. So it's finding out what we can do. So if we've been referred for psychotherapy on the NHS, it's what can we do in the meantime whilst we're waiting? And I'm a big fan of social prescribing. I'm a nurse, a non-medical prescriber, so I can prescribe all the medications available. But more and more, especially since I've been doing this secondment on suicide prevention, is the power of social prescribing. So that's doing things that you love, that you used to, and we spoke about maybe losing interest in those things, but it's about reconnecting with things that you love. It's, of course, connection with people with Parkinson's is incredibly important, but you know what, if hiking was your thing or chess was your thing, what can we do in the meantime whilst you're waiting for these other interventions on the NHS? What can we do with you sort of here and now? I'm a big fan as well of safety planning. And if you haven't heard of that, it's something that you can do for yourself. I have a safety plan. My colleagues, some of my mental health colleagues do as well, but a lot of the patients that we work with, I would really advocate that. And that's knowing your symptoms. So knowing when your mood perhaps is dropping, what does that look like? Sometimes as well, when you've got depression or anxiety, sometimes you're the last to know this is happening to you. So it's about sharing that with maybe your care partner, maybe your loved one. But it's about recognizing those signs and also knowing what has been helpful in the past, perhaps, to do something about it. So is it when I've had a bad night's sleep, is it saying, do you know what, I need a quiet day today, because I know if I do something very busy, that's going to make my mental health a lot worse. I'm going to feel a lot more anxious. Is it that when I'm starting to feel low in mood, that I need to get out for a walk, you know, because I know in the past, a walk in the woods, getting back to nature has really helped. But sometimes, again, when your thoughts are a little bit influenced by low mood, it's hard to see the wood through the trees, to use that nature analogy. So it's sometimes having a plan of what to do that you've kind of sorted out when you are in a better headspace, that if you recognize these things are happening, is to activate that, or getting a loved one to activate it for you. So I find those, they're free, they're simple to do, done collaboratively with your Parkinson's specialist or a loved one, works even better.
Fab advice. Another thing that people can access is, I suppose, going through your local advisor, who can, you know, your Parkinson's UK local advisor, who will also be able to point you in the directions of perhaps, you know, any services or resources that may be required, in addition to Parkinson's nurse who may be able to support you as part of that sort of multidisciplinary team. Oh, wow. Okay, definitely. So we're getting all the information and the strategies. This is great. It's a win-win pod for me. I suppose if I could then just move on, if we were thinking about younger people with Parkinson's, do either of you in your areas really notice there's a difference in presentation of potential mental health issues in people with the younger onset compared to those perhaps who are diagnosed later?
It can vary depending upon whether they have a genetic component. So at the National Hospital, we see, you know, rare things quite commonly. So we see quite a lot of people who have genetic forms of Parkinson's disease. So most people with Parkinson's will not have a known genetic form, but those who, but then at a specialist hospital, we do see a higher proportion of those. And some of those can be subject to a more aggressive form of Parkinson's, and that can bring with it quite a lot of additional difficulties. But in general, if it's just sort of common Parkinson's, I suppose, that's just happening below the age of 50, in the sort of young onset group, then, you know, I think it's similar, but it can feel quite lonely, because, you know, you might be the only person that you know that has Parkinson's in your age group. And then you try to access, you know, maybe local groups for young people with Parkinson's, and then you're sort of told that there aren't any, and that can be quite isolating. And so I think, you know, but it's also about being the author of your own life, right? So it's not, it's about sort of, well, if you are one of the few people, then maybe you know, reaching out to other people and trying to come up with some sort of fellowship yourself is a really good idea. So, you know, reaching out to other people through, I know some people that have done this through Facebook sites, of trying to identify other people with young onset Parkinson's and then developing a fellowship. I know some people that have gone to the Congress in Barcelona and found that really useful, just to meet other people with young onset Parkinson's. So it's about sort of taking greater control over the situation as much as you can. When their services aren't there, and also just sort of, you know, accessing other types of support, like exercise groups that are perhaps a bit more fun for you in your age group. So I know quite a few young people that are interested in boxing, or, you know, these sorts of, or maybe dancing or break dancing, you know, these sorts of more unusual perhaps, or types of exercise that younger people might be more interested in. And so it's about sort of finding the right sort of tailored support for them, but realizing that it's a long slog. If you've got young onset, you're going to have that for the rest of your life, and you've got a young age and you don't know any else of that. So it's recognizing the emotional impact, but also then just trying to work out what you can do to really help yourself sort of manage those extra burdens, I suppose.
Yeah, definitely. I agree with everything you say there, Jennifer. I'm a trustee on the on a young onset Parkinson's charity. So I speak quite regularly with younger people with Parkinson's, and something in terms of mental health issues that they experience is anxiety, you know, about what is this condition going to look like? And like you said, Jennifer, you know, I'm going to have this for the rest of my life. How is that going to look? But it's often these people are working as well, or may have young families or both. So it's about How am I going to navigate work? Do I tell them? Do I go to HR and explain to them about that? And Parkinson's UK have got some wonderful resources actually about working with when you have Parkinson's. And it's also sort of like, how do you tell your children if you have them that you have this condition? And that's incredibly anxiety provoking. But something that comes up quite often and that I've observed is apathy, where this sort of very little enjoyment in things, little enthusiasm to kind of get engaged in things. And certainly the people that I've recently spoke to about this said this was often a first symptom that they came across, sort of experienced, and didn't necessarily link it to a Parkinson's initially, but when they've become more educated about the condition, they look back and say, do you know, actually that was there years before. So I was asking some younger people with Parkinson's actually, what are your tips? So they were saying about being open with about the condition once you've kind of got your head around it, with perhaps at work and with friends, working at a pace that suits them, building that network around you, that mitigation of stress. We spoke about that earlier. And something that I absolutely love, and I hadn't really sort of heard the phrase really, about choosing joy. I thought I absolutely loved that. But it was about getting online, kind of finding, you know, what floats your boat. And when I was asking people as well, what lifts your mood? And these were younger onset Parkinson's. It was connecting with others. That was the number one. But also pets, walking the dog. And Neil, you spoke about the benefits of having a hound, and I absolutely agree. But music and singing in a group, that was seen to be really helpful. And again, you know, I'm sucking up to Julie here, but absolute exercise and those and Jennifer was talking about that sort of communal kind of groups of exercise and how important that was to people. And actually quite a few having like a cheeky glass of something and cake, all things helping, I suppose, increase those dopamine levels.
I just want to say I didn't bribe them at all before coming on the pod. I have met Jennifer before, but I've never met Emma before. There was no bribery, no corruption involved in any of the creation of this pod, that they've been such strong advocates of exercise. I think, you know, you've just touched on that a little bit there, Emma, is the stigma associated, you know, with when people are diagnosed with Parkinson's. And I think when you add, quite rightly mentioned apathy, we've mentioned anxiety and depression, when you add stigma into that mix as well, it just adds a whole element of challenge. I suppose, yeah. Neil, did you feel any challenges, if you mind me putting in your spot, when you were diagnosed? Did you feel quite comfortable talking about it, or how did you find it?
I found it quite difficult. I was diagnosed while I was still in work, and it is quite difficult. I mean, there's some people in your workplace you can speak to and things, but you may be in a meeting with people from maybe an outside organization, or some of your skills are not as good as they were. For example, my typing skills deteriorated with Parkinson's, and suddenly you're not as able to do the job as well, but people are still relying on you to do your job, which of course, you know, feeds into it. And a lot of the very good coping strategies Emma was coming up with, they're much harder to do if you're in work. If you've got a meeting you have to go every day at the same time every day, you can't say, oh no, I'm having a quiet restful day today. You still have to meet your targets and things. So maybe you have to, I mean, I was in a position where I could say, no, I'm not going to work anymore, I'm going to give up work. But if you're in young onset Parkinson's, you have to maybe consider, is this a job for me, or do I need to move into a different job or change my working patterns? You know, it does present a lot of challenges to be able to look after yourself so you can still give to your family and your workplace, because you have a commitment to them, the people you work with. And, you know, in my case, I have people working for me, and I, you know, you can't afford to let them down, but you have to be honest with yourself and say, what can I do, you know, with this condition but still be able to, you know, take an income in.
Yeah, just to chip in, I've sort of had a few conversations with people with young onset or who are still working, and I think just totally echoing what you were saying, Neil, about sort of the difficulty of having to manage, you know, full-time work whilst you're managing all the motor symptoms, and it can be really challenging. And so I think for some of the people that I've spoken to, what's been helpful is sort of thinking about working pattern, as you say, so maybe working from home a couple of days a week, or changing the hours, or so they don't have to commute every day, so the commute's not so exhausting. Obviously, it's not possible for every employer, but as you say, you know, sometimes you have to think about what's actually going to be sustainable for you long term, and so sort of maybe working from home sometimes, so also so that enables them to fit in exercise. So, you know, if you're at home more, then you can exercise in the morning or whatever, or go for a walk at lunch, well, maybe that isn't quite so possible when you're in the office. And also speaking to your bosses about the diagnosis and then seeing what they can offer you in terms of reasonable adjustments. And that's what Parkinson's UK can also really help you with, is sort of having those formal conversations and knowing what your rights are, what's available to you to change. But yeah, it's about sort of, I suppose it's about, as you say, Neil, it's about sort of being honest with yourself about what you're able to do physically, and also how it impacts you emotionally, you know, and the fatigue of working, what's going to be sustainable for you, and what's the sort of working patterns that work best for you that you can continue to do to put the food on the table.
And of course, you also have the other challenge at work, is you have to try and fit your medication in. So you may end up and food, you know, and you're in a meeting and suddenly your meeting's running late, you can't take your medication and eat. How do you cope? You know, it just all adds to the stress, etc., of somebody in the working place. So it's something I'm glad I managed to get out of. I mean, like we were speaking about problems with sleep, you know, if you're retired and you have a bad night's sleep, you can have a nap in the afternoon. You can't necessarily do that when you're in the workplace. So it just adds to all the life problems, just getting, building up and being there. I'm beginning to waffle up with Julie, sorry.
Oh, love a bit of waffle. It's not waffle. It's really lovely to have different people's perspectives on the call. I suppose one thing I just wanted to ask Emma, I suppose we've talked a lot about people living with Parkinson's and mental health issues, but it often, as you've already said, it's difficult sometimes for people with Parkinson's to realise that they perhaps are being anxious or their mood is low for a period of time. Is there any advice or strategies that carers can put in place, or loved ones? Because also it's a very difficult conversation often from the loved ones to bring it up, because it can be a sensitive topic area. And, you know, I have a lot of wives that come in, oh, we'll listen to you, but he would never listen to me. So you tell him this. And it's a difficult one to broach because, you know, it's a sensitive topic area for a number of people, and you know, I just wondered if you had any thoughts about how we can discuss that.
Well, I would always advocate for any from a clinician point of view, when we're putting strategies together, is to collaboratively do that with the family as well, where appropriate, if consent is given, obviously. Because they can often give a different perspective as well. And I think that also then helps that if, you know, when people are at home, is saying, you know, well, do you remember Emma was saying that when you start to say, well, I'm not going out today, or I'm not going to go to that club, that's a sign that maybe my mood is a bit low and we need to do something about it. So it's about education, isn't it? About what these different sort of mental health issues have and what it looks like and what you can do about it.
We said earlier when we were talking about anxiety, what can carers do to help? But those of us with Parkinson's, I mean, we have our carers and we need to look after them. Is there anything we can do to help with their mental health?
Ooh, good question. I run an online care partners support group once a month, And I would encourage my patients' relatives to come along to that. And it's a space where people can just sort of share how they're feeling, maybe get tips and advice from others in the same boat. And again, the feedback we've had from that group, and we've been running it just over a year now, is that people find it's just a safe space to say, do you know what, I need a break, or where is a good place just to take a break for a day? Is there, what would you recommend if I'm worried about leaving my partner at home, what can I do about that? You know, and it may be that someone says, well, do you know what, my next door neighbor's lovely and they'll come in and maybe do a bit of gardening whilst, you know, I go off and have a swim or something. So it's about, you're absolutely right, you know, we've got to look after the family's mental health as well. We work really closely so I work in Plymouth. We've got a brilliant organisation called Caring for Carers, and there's similar organisations all around the country where they are and they're often sort of linked to the health trusts and boards around the country, and they will do various different things. So they will offer, everybody that comes to my online care partner group will be offered a statutory carers assessment. And what that means is a series of questions looking at how you're coping. If you're an unpaid carer, are you collecting or are you claiming the right sort of benefits that you may be entitled to? Are you aware of the support that is out there for you? And it might be that a carers group, you know, hits the spot, but it might be that something more formal is needed. You know, in advanced Parkinson's, you know, often the care partner takes the majority of the physical care and assistance. So it's about, maybe do they need a break? Do we need to have maybe an agency come in and kind of help and relieve some of the work, some of the care duties? So it's about, yeah, it's definitely about being aware that if care partners are there, that they need support too. And there is help out there. And Parkinson's UK as well, awesome charity, and they have lots and lots of literature. The Parkinson's UK advisor are also really good to link into for family members, and I've had so much good feedback over the years from people that have linked in with those people.
I'd maybe just also add, if I may, that sometimes when you have Parkinson's, you know, if one person in the couple has Parkinson's, then the dynamic can sometimes always shift to the focus being on that person with Parkinson's. And sometimes it's just good to actually just, you know, just sort of try to recalibrate the dynamic a little by sort of focusing a bit, maybe asking, you know, Neil, maybe asking your partner, you know, how are they feeling emotionally, or, you know, trying to actually open up some of those conversations about how your partner is doing, and thinking and trying to direct a bit more of the attention and having that sort of conversation, or maybe actually really investing in the relationship by maybe just doing things that you both like as a couple and doing them and scheduling those into your week, as well as the things for each of you individually. So it's just to try to enhance that dynamic between the two of you, making sure you're having these good conversations between you, and that it's not always just focus on one of you, because that can lead to frustration you know, in the best of circumstances. So yeah, I think that I would add that in as well.
What we'll try and do is when we, in the publication of this podcast, we'll put some of the links to some of these support agencies that are mentioned in the blurb. So if you just click on these links, which will be below the published podcast, you can maybe access some of the resources that both Jennifer and Emma have mentioned today. I just want to finish up with one question, perhaps just in line with what this being a bit of a research focus on the pod, is this: what research opportunities are there for people with Parkinson's to get involved with studies, particularly with the focus on mental health? Because, you know, as we've discussed in this podcast, you know, apathy and depression, anxiety are quite prevalent. So how can people get involved? Do either of you have any insight into what research projects are perhaps recruiting or studies that people could get involved with?
In terms of research, a lot of the Parkinson's nurses and the clinicians will be aware of research studies. And if they're not quite sure, there'll be a research department somewhere in the NHS organisation that they work for. So I think if it's not offered up as an option in your consultation, I think it's so important for people with Parkinson's to be aware that they can participate in research. And it's not just clinical drug trials. There's surveys, there's different sort of cognitive tests, there's just asking your opinion on things. So there's different forms of research that are out there that are absolutely fantastic. And again, just from an anecdotal point of view, what I have found is that my patients that participate in research, it improves their mental health as a bit of an offshoot. It feels like they are contributing to something bigger than them. And there are so many brilliant studies out there. And I think hopefully Jennifer may know a few of those that are going on currently.
Well, I would totally agree with what you say. And then also I would just put a shout out for the Parkinson's, is it Get Involved sort of research function that they have on the website. So you can just sort of like plug in your details and sign up to getting involved in research trials. And I have used that to recruit participants for research before, and it's just been amazing. So, you know, we put out some information about some research we were doing into young onset Parkinson's, and we got loads of people asking to participate straight away. So it's great, because some of the research you can do from home, just, you know, on your computer or speaking to the researchers by phone, and then sometimes, you know, it's going into the hospital or the university to take part. One that's available at the moment that I think is still available is being run by Annette Schrag at UCL, which is about anxiety, treating anxiety, and it's about sort of trying to understand a bit more about anxiety symptoms and the best sorts of treatment for it. And so that's called the PD trial, and that's funded by Cure Parkinson's Trust. And so, you know, you can contact or you can look at the details of that on the Cure Parkinson's Trust website. But you know, for another research trial a couple of research trials are going on for hallucinations at the moment. So hallucinations are very common in Parkinson's disease. They can range from being sort of that having a sense of someone standing behind you in the corner of your eye, or something moving in the corner of your eye, up to these sorts of unusual images that might come to your mind's eye just straight in front of your eyes. And these sorts of false images are often very common, but sometimes they can cause distress. And when they become distressing, then we obviously need treatments to stop them. And there's a couple of treatments trials out at the moment. One is using something similar to cannabis to try to reduce the distress associated with hallucinations, and others using another medication for Parkinson's hallucinations. And so these are called the, I think it's CAN-PDP and the Top Hat research trials. They're both funded by Parkinson's UK, so you can probably find out about them through Parkinson's UK website, particularly for the sort of get involved in research trials. And I totally agree with you, Emma, that so many people take part in the research, and it really increases their sense of being involved, sense of having a sense of control over you know, finding proper solutions to the issues that are happening for them and for other people. And I think that feels really good. And so I really, you know, I would really recommend it as not only just to help research and to be part of the cure, but also to actually have a beneficial effect for yourself. So yeah, totally agree.
So what Jennifer was just referring to there, you can go onto Parkinson's UK Take Part Hub, and that's where you can type in your postcode, and that gives you an option to look at what research studies are currently live and recruiting at the moment near your postcode. But you can also add various filters to see whether you would rather just do a questionnaire-based study, which Emma alluded to, or whether you would rather be involved in something with a little bit more commitment. So you can self-select based on that. So that might be somewhere that's useful. And again, we can pop that link in the blurb that goes to the podcast for people that want to have a look. So it doesn't really matter if you live in the north of Scotland or at the very edge of Cornwall, there's always something that you can participate in regardless of how far you live from some of these big research centres. And I certainly know Neil participated in a number of Parkinson's research studies, and I think, you know, we recently had our Highland gathering, and I think that was quite a powerful talk, just as you both have said, about how empowering that is to feel that you're contributing to some development of some future knowledge that will help the other people within the Parkinson's community. So just before we wrap up, is there anything you wanted to add in relation to that, Neil? I've just stolen your thunder.
Yes, you have. And there are other rules within the Parkinson's UK research community to help. There's PPI, which is not something to do with insurance, but is to help researchers design their trials and make them as accessible to people with Parkinson's as possible. There's lay grant reviewers who look at the grants, look at the trials that people want to do, and put a Parkinson's spin on somebody with Parkinson's on the trial. And there's also something that I'm going to steal David Dexter's thunder here. If you want to see a consultant more often, get on a trial, because you will see a consultant far more often than you would under the normal run of the mill under the NHS.
That's right, Neil. I have to say, I will support you in that. That's exactly what David Dexter said when he came to our Highland gathering that we had just a couple of weeks ago. But you're absolutely right, Neil. For those people that maybe want to be a participant in the research study, that's maybe step one. But if you really enjoy that, just like you have, you become somebody who's also become an advisor or a lay reviewer. And there's lots of support within Parkinson's UK to develop those roles, and then really can influence the direction and studies which are funded by Parkinson's UK. So you could become quite a significant research advocate, which is a really positive role to have, which is just great. Well, I can't actually believe we've been talking for all this time. I think I thought to start with, would we even manage to fill the time? But we've had a mammoth session. So a huge thank you to Emma for your time this afternoon, and for yourself, Jennifer. It's been hugely insightful. And thank you for my new wingman, Neil. You've been a star on the podcast, and being able to put up with me trying to chair a session as informally as possible. So a huge thank you all for your time. And
thank you.
I look forward to seeing you again soon.
Bye. Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.